Okay, so welcome to the first of the podcasts with the MA in Geography and Spatial Justice. And today it is Krahor Omwenig, who's a PhD student in the Geography Department, whose PhD is looking at sort of low carbon transition, Green New Deal, through the lens or the empirical focus of electric vehicles and the kinds of policies and actors around the development or phasing in of electric vehicles. But today he's going to talk to us more specifically around the maybe less well understood, you know, geographies of the low carbon transition and the move towards clean energy and the ways in which that takes shape or manifests in particular places and particular communities around energy infrastructures and so on. So maybe the best place to start, Krahor, is to say a little bit about yourself and maybe how you got interested in this area, these topics.
So as you mentioned, my PhD focuses on low carbon transition with a particular focus on electric vehicles. I've always been interested in kind of capturing the role of digital technology in change in the city. But often my focus is in kind of interurban and intra-urban developments and actors. And I suppose the research here was trying to kind of get me away from that kind of thinking about cities, particularly in the global north. And then through my engagement with this kind of new literature, although built on a lineage of kind of environmental justice, around critically analysing Green New Deals and just transitions. My first entry point was kind of through new works around extractivism within South America. So I was interested in kind of the different supply chains that produce kind of rare earth minerals for storage. And then what also then came up was sort of the new, sites that seem to be appearing around onshore wind. So I think because of the spatial extensiveness of onshore wind relative to more kind of what we call subterranean regimes of oil and gas, they're far more spatial extensive. A lot of this wind production is being domesticated as well. So there's new pressures on kind of rural communities. So I was particularly interested in focusing on the Irish context of that and looking at those pressures. So what came up to me then was I began to look at, I suppose, different anti-wind politics in the context of Ireland and trying to understand how these kind of politics of knowledge and different agencies emerge against the sort of these pressures of renewable energy regimes. And one thing that kind of came to focus was, this new connection between, smart cities and data and digital life and these onshore wind farms or these renewable energy regimes. So we're starting to see the emergence of corporate purchase power agreements between onshore wind farms and in Ireland in particular, with data centers, for example. So this really, my engagement through this was through your work initially, so Patrick Bresnan and Patrick Brody. And initially came to mind was one of the farms was on the Meanbog Wind Farm, which is located in Donegal. So the Meanbog Wind Farm have a corporate purchase power agreement with Amazon Web Services. So for anyone who doesn't know Amazon, they're this massive company that are mostly known for delivering products. I think they deliver like 3.5 billion products every year, something like that. So I was really interested in the sort of the connection between these two and how companies like Amazon, as a part of their kind of their greening strategy or to decarbonize, they begin to create these kind of purchase agreements with these onshore wind energies. And this, I suppose, was my kind of entry point. But I wasn't, I suppose what I was looking to do then was kind of expand upon that. And rather than look at the particular relationship between Amazon and the Meanwhile Wind Farm, I wanted to kind of get into the kind of political economy of the wind farm owners or the producers. And then also look at the kind of, I suppose, the knowledges and agencies that were being expressed through the kind of anti-wind politics within the area. So I thought it would be interesting then, as a kind of way that there's already a kind of some work done on Meanbog Wind Farm, maybe that I could contribute to that, so you can almost create a more sort of robust case study then in that way to make that kind of contribution. I suppose, that's it. In terms of the literatures that I've begun to engage with, so two major kind of authors were Theoria Francos and Martin Arboleda. Their work around kind of extractivism, particularly contextualizing it within a sort of a global supply chain of energy, has been really important. And I suppose that's been important for me to kind of take me away from understanding these sites of production as just situated within Ireland, but rather they're a part of a more globalized connection around that data, but also around perhaps how these things are financed, and then, you know, the different sort of ownership structures or corporate structures and how they're kind of structurally laid out or spatially laid out then as well. So it's not just the situation in Meanbog, for example, isn't just in Meanbog. It's a part of a broader context of Ireland and European energy. So also I've engaged with your work around the kind of this kind of sort of Mobius strip of wind and data, and I think it's been really useful because part of my work on electric vehicles really connects sort of digital life and this new sort of the new digital ways of driving cars and the connection with apps. It's been really useful to kind of take me away from that and to understand this kind of this broader connection with data, and then that's connection with materiality and its carbon footprint, which is interesting sort of contradiction, because, you know, our understanding of these technologies is that they decarbonize, but you can see just through the way their relationships are structured that it's a much more complicated affair. And then another author or another scholar slash artist slash activist who I've been engaging with has been Vincenzo Serafis. So I had the kind of joy of listening to her come in and talk about some of the work that she's been doing on the Sparren around anti-gold mining. And it was just really useful to kind of start thinking about the different ways that local communities can resist and subvert these sort of accumulation strategies, I suppose, or these and how they can produce different politics of knowledges that can challenge them too. And then ultimately what I wanted to kind of expand upon was an idea of supply chain justice, and that I suppose was to recognize the different sort of sites of disruption among these kind of, you know, renewable energy supply chains, on ways that we can begin to think about knowledge and agency among them, and ways that we can begin to challenge the sort of the industrial, maybe orthodox politics of renewable energy. I first began to look at Meanbog Wind Farm in kind of two different ways.
I might just before you go to talk about Meanbog, I was wondering if you could say a little bit more. I mean, that was, you know, a great survey of, like, you know, some the literature. And the one of the concepts was around extractivism and the work of Theoria Francos and Arboleda, and their work obviously is focused on Latin America and in Chile and in Ecuador and Bolivia and other South American countries. But I was wondering if you could say a little bit about, I guess, how extractivism, which is a term that comes out of those contexts, you know, could is usefully or may usefully be applied in the Irish context. You've already touched on it a bit, but it might be worth just sort of elaborating on that or saying a bit more about it.
It's actually kind of one of the things that I kind of struggled with as I was doing the research, because you're taking this particular concept that has this lineage around, you know, extractivism, particularly within Latin America, as you mentioned. But to take that and then kind of position it within Ireland, which is a richer country, we often benefit from the sort of the types of extractivism that are going on. So it was one of the issues I struggled with. But I suppose what I thought might be an interesting goal then was, rather than trying to kind of co-opt those kind of ways of thinking and then say, oh, see, it happens to Irish people too, which can sometimes happen, I think. The idea was that actually if we can begin to show these kind of struggles, perhaps we can sort of begin to sort of fold the sort of agencies and solidarity across space, that people within the Irish could then, you know, these the people within these renewable, people within these, say, for example, the Meanbog wind farm, or people within the Finn Valley region of Donegal, where the Meanbog wind farm is situated, can begin to understand that their struggle is part of this broader context of renewable extractivism. So I suppose that was, rather than think of it as a kind of thing that co-opts that, or I thought it was a useful way of sort of saying that, yeah, this happens also in Ireland, and that we shouldn't be rendering, I suppose, these sites within the Global South as these kind of referent objects, as something that we need to protect. And actually, we need to recognise that there's also, you know, there's also environmental, rural environmental struggles in Ireland that can connect. And we can actually, we could imagine that we could begin to kind of share these knowledges and follow them across space to create these kind of interest and sort of intensity of scale that we can begin to challenge these renewable wind farms. So I hope that answers the question.
No, definitely. Yeah. And I think you're exactly right. It is a kind of a nuanced one. And what you're doing in your work that I've seen, it's exactly, you know, you're not conflating or collapsing things into each other. But, you know, by looking at chains, so supply chains, you know, you can recognize that there are, you know, sites of extraction and sites of exploitation without having to say that they're the same. You know, you don't have to say that what's happening in the Andes in Bolivia is the same as what's happening in Donegal, but you can say that they're equally sort of, you know, problematic, and they share some elements within this highly uneven supply chain. So I think that that's exactly right. Maybe you could say then, you were going to go on to talk more about the site itself, Meanbog, and the wind farm.
Yeah, so the way I kind of wanted to look at Meanbog was to look, I suppose, at the political economic configurations, particularly of the corporations that own the wind farm, rather than Amazon Web Services. And then I was interested in looking at, I suppose, the kind of knowledges and agencies that's produced through the kind of anti-wind politics within Meanbog Wind Farm. So I suppose, firstly, just to touch on the political economic configurations. So there's a really interesting politics of scale, I think, that's kind of expressed through Meanbog Wind Farm. And I think, firstly, the nature of that, I think, is expressed through ideas of like subsidy-free. So the corporate purchase power agreement between Amazon Web Services and the Meanbog Wind Farm, or Invis Energy, who are the owners of Meanbog Wind Farm, it makes claims of kind of subsidy-free. And these like subsidy-free renewable projects are being rolled out all across the UK and the European Union. And I just think it's an interesting dynamic, because we've created all of these kind of structures at a national level and both at a European level, that kind of seeks to finance these projects. But part of these part of this renewable financing is that you need kind of just transition mechanisms. So there has to be some forms of oversight that include community. So I just thought the notion of subsidy free, it seemed to me a particular device that the, you know, the Invis Energy and Amazon could kind of distance themselves from that sort of oversight that was being put forward by these particular mechanisms, both on a national and kind of supranational scale. And then also alongside of that, initially Invis Energy applied for 49 wind farms. So that was rejected because of the ecological significance of the site. So the site is host of 7% of the hen harrier population of Ireland. It's also it's quite close to the EU protected salmon populations. So I think apart then, you know, from this, then 19 were accepted. But then through the county development plan, which is done by Donegal County Council, which is a municipal level, they omitted any, they didn't include, say, the Mean Bog area as a site of development within their county development plan because of this, what was considered ecological significance. So this then was then challenged by Invis Energy. And through that then, Donegal County Council had to, you know, pull back the omission of Main Bog as an area of ecological significance from the county development plan. So I thought it was interesting how they can distance themselves from state oversight and European oversight while at the same time using these kind of structures then to also challenge municipalities who are trying to protect the ecological significance of the area. So I thought that was really interesting, and I think it shows a kind of an interesting tension between, I suppose, the different knowledges at different scales. And then that kind of led me into looking at the kind of corporate structures of this energy. So, or the Mean Bog Wind Farm. So Mean Bog, how the community of Finn Valley initially came into contact with Mean Bog was through its company, which is Planry Limited. So eventually, I think this was kind of, they worked through this, and then it turned out Planry is owned by Invis Energy, which is a company based out in Cork. And then what you see then though is Invis Energy then is owned by two parent companies, which is Enerco Energy, which is owned by another company, the Cradle Group, and Asper Investment Management, which is a UK company, which was formerly of HG Renewables, who are formerly of Merrill Lynch. So Merrill Lynch were these like massive investment players in the noughties, and they played a really significant role in creating the collateralized debt obligations that ultimately, I think, led to, well, they were a cornerstone of the global financial crisis. So I thought it was interesting that you could trace the kind of lineage of financing that were going in to companies like Invis Energy back to the likes of Merrill Lynch. What would be interesting to do then was to do a kind of an archival study and to begin to look at the practices of these different companies. And then what I found is that its parent company, Enerco Energy, who's then owned by the Cradle Group, they actually operate through a lot of questionable practices all across Ireland. So what you could see was a similar situation happened in Cork County Council against Enerco Energy, and they brought judicial proceedings against Cork County Council. They prompted a protest of 200 families in Kerry against its subsidiary Stax Mountain Wind Farm, and there was also, it faced opposition in West Cork over fears of fire and toxic pollution through its affiliate company Wingleaf. So you could imagine you're witnessing, like, you have Invis Energy is owned by Enerco, but Enerco own, you know, they own Cleanrath, Stax Mountain Wind Farm and Wingleaf, and all of these different companies are kind of operating under the same corporate veil all across Ireland, and they're doing practices which are been resisted and have what seems to be negative consequences for local communities. So I just thought it was really interesting to kind of begin to lift that corporate veil. But then that kind of led on to the second part of my research was to begin to engage with the sort of agencies and knowledges being produced on ground. Because you have this kind of corporate structure, how these communities come into contact is mostly through, you know, the operations that are on ground, and it's incredibly difficult to resist, you know, these really complex corporate structures that, you know, operate, you know, both nationally and through like financial regimes that are quite strong within European Union. So I thought it'd be useful then to look at how these are kind of playing out on the ground.
That's fascinating. You know, so much information that you've just mapped out there. And I was wondering, you know, if you could say something, and this might come out when you talk about the kind of resistance and the campaign of the Finn Valley community group, but that kind of ownership, that nested kind of ownership and network, can you see how that, I mean, what are the kind of advantages of that? Like, how do they leverage, you talked about knowledge and you talked about, you know, scale, is it, and obviously they have resources, but maybe are there also limitations of that kind of, that distance, you know, from the actual sites where these wind farms are going to be built, that can actually be a bit of an Achilles heel for these projects. So maybe, you know, what are the advantages and what are the sort of disadvantages, particularly as we're trying to think about this from the perspective of, you know, environmental justice and efforts.
Well, you could imagine the sort of, there's a someone, this is, you could just imagine it, but you could imagine there's someone who maybe runs out of Cork who's then, you know, has to call into someone who's in the UK, and these are all on a kind of, you know, environmental impact reports or assessments within the area, and these assessments are considered okay. But even though with opposition, they're saying, you know, look, we have these particular structures and these particular ways of measuring it that say, you know, it's okay to have these wind farms. They're not actually based within the area. They might have an engineer go out and visit, but, you know, it's not inclusive to the particular communities on the ground. But I think in another sense, it's incredibly useful for them to have these corporate structures, because it's a way, again, you can distance yourself from these particular scales. So you have these, the distanciation from, you know, the European Union and the state, but also you can distance yourself from these local communities. So the first time that I ever came across this was through the Bhopal disaster. And this is a really, really famous incident of this, where, you know, Union Carbide used their kind of corporate veil to, you know, their position within the United States. They're very typical. And you can imagine these similar, you know, I'm not trying to compare it to the Bhopal disaster, but it's a similar corporate structure that you can create these forms of distanciation that is around, you know, you could argue, I think, trying to maybe avoid forms of restitution, but then also understanding that there are particular knowledge systems that are being rolled out on the ground that, you know, always play to your advantage. And then you have like these interesting knowledge flows between them. You know, there's judicial proceedings being brought by the Clean Rath Company, who are owned by Enerco, who happen to own, you know, the main bog wind farm through Invis Energy, who are also rolling out these same judicial proceedings. You know, they understand how these operations work, and it's, you know, it makes it incredibly difficult on people who you know, who don't have these sort of advantages. So I think that speaks to the reason why it's really useful to begin to connect these anti-wind politics on the ground, so they can begin, I suppose, to create, I suppose, better, for a business term, synergy, I suppose, that they can resist these. But
I think it's interesting, now you'll go on to talk about it, but how the kinds of there's a sense in which that distance, which is about you know, I'm guessing that there's also certain kinds of rhythms to these projects as well, you know, expectations that these things get rolled out, and, you know, it's part of a portfolio of projects, that when they hit the ground and there's friction, when there's this opposition, that it can actually be, in terms of delaying these things or mucking up those smooth flows of things, it can actually be effective, you know, even if it seems to be localized, it seems to be you know, under-resourced in terms of a campaign, it's not making demands at a policy level necessarily, but these kinds of frictions in place can actually be effective. But maybe you'll go on, you can talk more about that now.
Yeah, so I mean, how I could see these frictions playing out, and these kind of, I suppose, what I've been kind of conceptualizing as a, you know, kind of politics of knowledge, or, you know, particular knowledges, and agencies, particularly in the form of resistance, again, how I've kind of seen them playing out is kind of in three different ways within Mean Bog. I don't want to speak on behalf of the Finn Valley community and say this is what they're doing. This is just an observation that I've had through engaging kind of with their responses to newspaper articles, and through engaging with their social media. But from what I can see, is there's kind of three interesting ways that this is kind of taking shape, and it's through kind of community building, I suppose, is one aspect of it. And then another, as I looked at, is kind of place making, and then another is the kind of relationship with the ecology. So from, you know, community building perspective, I thought it was fascinating that they organize 5 kilometer runs, they organize dances, and this is all to fund this kind of resistance. So, you know, it may not seem, even if they manage to kind of slow down how it's rolled out, it's still actually an integral part of how they practice, you know, their community and how they come together as a community. So in that way, it's really interesting. And another sense was that they organize different academics to come in and give different talks. Maybe it's on the Boglins, or maybe it's someone who's an expert on low frequency sound. And you can see how actually their understanding of and how they weave together their community is actually quite grounded in scientific knowledge as well, which I thought was really, really fascinating. But one of the areas that I thought was incredible was they mostly operate, as far as I could see, through Facebook. So they have approximately about 2,000 followers on Facebook. And you can see on Facebook how they begin to connect with these different communities, both within the Irish context of these anti-wind farm communities and all across the world. And I just thought this was fascinating, because you could see they start to share placards that you can use for protests, that you can print out for free. Or we hear a lot of this talk around kind of Scandinavian countries like Norway, like Denmark, and in terms of the speed of their rollout. And often you can see these competitions and collaborations between regions who use these countries as a form of trying to bolster their renewable energy rollout. But actually these anti-wind politics in Meanbog uses the anti-wind politics that's occurring in this country to kind of counteract that as well. I thought this was fascinating, because then the sense of community, yeah, it was, you know, it was grounded in the, you know, within Finn Valley, it was a ground, it's quite local, but in the same respect, it connected to this anti-wind political community that was playing out online. And you could see that kind of interplay between these different politics of scale that you could see in action with how, you know, these renewable energies are being rolled out, but also how they try and use these different connections to create an intensity of scale, I suppose, almost, so that they can take ideas that are rolled out in Denmark to then kind of challenge the energy, you know, the renewable energy regimes that are, you know, getting foothold in their area. So I think the community building aspect was fascinating, and the next aspect was placemaking. So I was really interesting, because through my engagement with kind of environmental justice, there seems to be this lineage of work around kind of these dichotomies between kind of wild and civilized, and you know, these progress, you know, progress and nostalgia, I suppose, almost, and how often it seems as if the civilized is trying to, you know, re-civilize or develop, you know, these places, but actually they use the kind of wilderness and types of nostalgia and types of looking back to try and I suppose make sense of their place, to give a sense of place, and to see that this place is of ecological and historic significance, and it's a part of, you know, how we identify as a community. So one of the examples was in Barnesmore Gap, which is an area where within the region where the developers are planning to roll out wind farms. They talk about kind of old stories, and they publish this old stories of Barnesmore Gap, and how the automobile, if a black pig travels through Barnesmore Gap, it was considered the end of the world. And they talk about how the first automobile moved through the gap, and this was, you know, considered sort of foreshadowing that end, which I just thought was really fascinating, how they pulled together these different histories, but also how they used their sense of wilderness to sort of, you know, to try and counteract these types of progression. Now, this is complicated as well, because it tries to tie them into kind of spectacle economies, and it says, like, this is really important for the economy, it's going to ruin the landscape, which I think is equally important as well. But so it's not so much just built around wilderness, but, you know, particular components of it around kind of the wild and the importance of it, as an ecological space is, I just thought it was really interesting how they use that. And it was also interesting because I've engaged with two artists, Ruth Clinton and Niamh Moriarty, and their work around kind of nostalgia and progress, and these kind of the sort of the tensions between the two. I thought was incredibly interesting, because they kind of look at through progress what stories get left behind. I thought that this is something that they're trying to capture. They're trying to protect these stories, but also use them as a way of producing knowledge and resisting. So, yeah, I thought that was incredibly interesting. And then, finally, I looked at the relationship with the ecology in terms of the sort of knowledges and agencies being produced. And I'd done that through looking at a particular event. So on the 13th of November, there was a peat slide on the Meanbog wind farm site. I don't know if I mentioned this, hopefully I did, but part of their sort of strategy of resisting this, they've been, talking about the insecurity of these kind of peatlands, of these peat bogs. And this is something that's been ongoing as part of the kind of discourse around and as part of the debate. I mentioned the 13th of November, there was this really significant pollution event. So there's still, again, an environmental impact report or assessment to be done on it. But there's really, really large concerns about the damage that it might do to the local European Union protected salmon populations. So there's really interesting questions about how these projects get kind of green lighted, even though it was in the context that you had these kind of resistances and knowledges being produced in the background. And one of the things, I suppose, that was kind of one of the narratives that was being put forward was that there's like a slow death in Irish nature. I thought this was interesting because you have this sort of slowness that this local community, this slow violence that these local communities kind of felt, and they were trying to put it forward, and these projects were getting rolled out anyway, and then it culminated in this, this kind of really spectacular event. If you look it up, it looks incredible. You can see trees kind of sliding down the bog. You can just see the bog just spread across all of the soil. And 2 days, I think, after this event, and like, let's not forget that the kind of livelihoods, is attached to the kind of the landscape. People are often in these rural places, I think, they're more likely to be farmers. They're more likely to kind of work. So this is attached to their livelihoods as well. There's a really big concern here. And 2 days after this event, Enerco Energy, so not under Invis Energy, under Enerco Energy this time, sent out a letter to local communities saying that we're planning on expanding the wind farm operations within the region. So there wasn't even a time to really have these kind of assessments, or let alone kind of, I suppose, have some sort of grievances or, to really get over the anxiety of this really, really bad event.
And that kind of points a little bit to the point we were saying about how there's a distance between the company, this corporate structure, and what's happening on the ground, because that's a mistake, right? It's a mistake that they sent out that letter, because it's only just going to throw, fuel on the fire. I mean, I can't imagine how angry that would make the local communities. In the context of that, disaster, which made national headlines, but it made the national media for sure. So something interesting about how, what you described about the Finn Valley campaign is that they draw a lot of their power from what is specific to that place, the stories they draw on, the ecology, and yet they are able to connect with other groups elsewhere. And I think there's something about how you can build coalitions or build alliances with others in very different contexts through an emphasis on your differences almost. It's actually quite different to the kind of scale of standardization, like the environmental impact assessment. That's kind of a knowledge of standardization. Whereas what you seem to be teasing out a bit is how scale can actually operate through difference too. And there seems to be something very interesting about that.
I think just to touch on that, it was one of the things that as I was kind of conducting this research, I was also conducting interviews for my PhD. And one of the touch points that I like to get at is kind of their views on lithium extractivism within the global south. And there is a sense, I think, within Ireland of, you know, that, well, that's a direct response that I received from someone was, well, that's that state's problem, or that's, you know, that's their issue. I don't see why I as a consumer should be held responsible for the sort of the businesses and the states and their relationship within that state to produce these forms of extractivism. And I think that's one of the reasons that I suppose I try to expand upon that idea of a supply chain, because you can see that there are these different differences, like you mentioned, constitutive of that. But it's trying to draw together that, you know, there are differences between lithium extractivism within South America, but we can actually see we can create these kind of incredible intensities. And I think as Irish and environmentalists, I think we need to consider that a little bit more, not only to consider the sort of anti-wind politics as a legitimate struggle, but also that we need to kind of try and draw all these different forms of struggle together. So I hope that touched on.
No, that's you definitely did. And I don't know, because we're finishing up now, but if you wanted to say anything as a final note about, you know, what, you know, you, but also, you know, other kinds of engaged scholars, whether geographers or environmental scientists or whatever, about how they might, I don't know, further these kinds of, you know, these kinds of analyses and these kinds of activism, I guess. If you wanted to just say something about that, the different ways you can.
Yeah, I suppose this is kind of tentative research. I haven't, you know, engaged with it as much as I would like to. But I think one of the interesting ways would be perhaps to begin to disentangle those political economies. Again, we talk about scale, but how can we sort of upscale that? How can we begin to see these connections between these communities, perhaps within the Irish context? So certainly looking at the broader political economy of renewable energy. And I think there's also kind of scope then to begin to make those connections then across the globe. And I think in that way, when we talk of ideas of kind of Green New Deals, that sort of progress, this stuff is going to be becoming more and more prevalent. So I think to kind of get at the kind of different agencies and trying to make those connections, I think is an essential move, I think, going forward for anyone interested in geographic research.
Great, that's really excellent. You managed to bring it all the way back to Green New Deal, which is kind of how we started, and you know, the context for your research. And I think you've done an amazing job at taking a particular case study, you know, a particular site, Meenbog Wind Farm, and linking it to the kind of corporate structures, the political economy of renewable energy, but also these really interesting sort of, you know, politics which are happening on the ground, but are not just localized, you know, that are making connections. And they're connections that, as you say, I think, you know, researchers need to do, you know, more to help through their analysis, but also through their dissemination of their work. And hopefully this podcast, it will reach a few ears, and, you know, it'll make people think differently about the kind of, you know, the brave new world of electric cars and data-driven solutions and so on. So thanks a million, Cruachan, and best of luck with the rest of your research.
Thanks so much for having me.